simply seem to see one side or one aspect of this multidimensional being, and yet they don't quite fully grasp what he's done. So, Dr. Hasani, tell us, you know, because you are a researcher and an academic in the Holy Seminaries of Qom, as well as for the academia in Tehran, tell us, how does one actually approach this personality?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
This is a very delicate subject.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to give you
sure.
the most simple example in order how to approach mm-hmm. to study such a person like Imam Khomeini, peace be upon him. And by the way, we are going to try.
Mm.
You know, there is no yeah. claim on our side.
Absolutely.
This is for sure.
I mean, really, yeah, of course. I mean, trying is the word.
In order to understand somebody, you have to know the background of his life.
Sure.
I give it to you simple. Mm. The way that you should study somebody's life, you can look at what kind of claim he has, or she, for that matter.
Right.
What the claim might be, this is the beginning of to enter the gate of studying. You know, in English, the word search and research.
Yeah.
Search is more simpler than research, of course.
Of course it is.
When you lose something, you know, let's suppose you lose your car key.
You're right.
And if you ask your wife, where is that?
Yeah. The natural, and she always tells you it's
exactly,
in your pocket.
But to get serious, if it's not in your pocket and you misplace it,
sure.
the natural thing to say is, why don't you look for it?
Yeah.
Why don't you search for it?
Search for it.
But you don't use the word research.
No, you don't.
If you search for it once, if you look for it once, and you still cannot find it, they might say to you, why don't you re-look somewhere else?
Sure.
In order to understand so many different things, different phenomena, if you look at the word itself, it helps you to begin with. Let me give you an example. What Imam Khomeini claimed in his holy life,
sure.
that 80 some years of his age
sure.
within us, that was a big claim. I can tell you right away, he had the same claim that Prophet did.
And that, what claim was that?
The claim is that everybody should live according to the rules and laws of the Creator to be a good person.
Right.
For example, in order to study the life, the holy life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his holy progeny.
Sure.
In order to understand Islam, you have to study his life. In order to understand what kind of background he's coming from, what kind of claim, and that was a big claim, by
yes.
the way.
Yes.
He was Rahmatan lil Alameen.
That's right, the mercy to
for
mankind.
The entire mankind.
For the whole of mankind, yes.
Not
yes.
just the mankind of his own time,
sure.
but for the rest of creation.
Yes.
For
and of course, the Holy Prophet had to also validate his prophethood
exactly.
as well, because there were many other monotheistic followers, or Hanifs even, mm-hmm. who followed Prophet Abraham, who followed Prophet Moses, for example, or Christianity as Prophet Jesus.
Which is a chain order.
Yeah, chain order.
Of
but
the
they,
same message.
But they said, as far as they were concerned, they turned around and they said to the Holy Prophet, look, we've been given the last revelation. We have the last claim on this matter. Where do you come into all this?
Mm-hmm. So, in order to study Islam and the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him,
sure.
the first thing comes to your mind, the location, the geography
right.
that he lived in.
Right.
Of course, it was Arabian Peninsula.
Uh-huh.
But in order to look at the bigger picture, you have to study the entire globe at that time.
Yes.
This is something, you know, often we forget or we take for granted.
Yes.
We say it's enough to learn about the... It wasn't a new religion. It was the continuation of all the religion that Prophet Abraham was talking about, Prophet Noah, and so on and so
sure,
forth.
Because
It was the completion of the whole program. So one thing comes to mind, you know, during the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, the ignorant of the people at the time. For example, they killed their own daughters by their own hand.
Yes.
For whatever the reason. We're not going to get into that.
No.
But my question to you is this,
sure.
Brother Ejaz.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about what people did in China back then?
Yes, I have.
But you have to put everything because in perspective.
Because you're right. No, what
you
I'm saying
about is civilization, you talk about the culture.
Exactly,
here.
Because you know what you're saying is, and it's beautifully put, and that's absolutely right, that you know when you think of 7th century,
mm-hmm.
you have to think exactly what the world was like in the 7th century.
Exactly. You have to study Romans Persian, they called them.
Yeah. I mean, in the 7th century, Rome itself as a republic had stood for almost 1,000 years. And, you know, had conquered most of the known world at that time.
That is true.
And the thing is that, as you say, we are putting everything in a context. So what you're saying is the beginning of your search is really
By definition. Research is not something just, you know, you do it on surface.
Exactly.
You have to go into a deeper...
And more broader understanding of exactly what's happening.
All different phenomena that you can find.
Exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
So... Indian, for example, Chinese back
exactly.
then,
yeah.
Persians, mm. Romans, mm-hmm. how about Egyptians?
Yes. One of the oldest standing civilizations in the region.
See, you have to think about the whole thing, the
sure.
whole picture.
Yeah.
Same thing goes with the life of Imam Khomeini, mm. peace be upon him.
Yes, quite.
You have to study not just what was going on inside Iran back mm. then,
mm.
okay?
Mm.
Domestically, you have to know
mm.
what kind of mentality people had back then.
Sure.
What kind of... economical situation they were in.
In other words, in terms of understanding how outstanding and how awesome Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi was in terms of what he, as you say, what he claimed, but we have to see it in the light of the fact that he's in the face of a very dominant, powerful culture at that
exactly.
time. For which they had no answer.
The position of Iran domestically...
Yeah.
In the regional, in what they call the Middle East,
sure.
and the role of foreigners.
Yes.
American government.
Both in the country and outside
the country.
Both in
the country and outside.
Yeah.
All these different phenomena, different realities on the ground,
mm.
it affects your research.
Of course it does.
And it draws the conclusion differently.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes.
What kind of economical situation was established in Iran before revolution, and you have to get you have to go way back at least for 20 years before revolution.
Yes.
What kind of mentality Imam, what kind of background Imam Khomeini was coming from?
Yes.
This is very important in doing research.
Yeah.
And you always have to go back again and do the check and balance.
Exactly.
And check it with the references.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that, you know, like as you point out, I mean, there's many references involved here because Imam Khomeini is coming on the back, not only on the back, but also was leading in many ways this very revolutionary change in Iran because, you know, the fact that, you know, he had a referendum right at the beginning, which was outstanding. I mean, nobody expected that a guy who would come out of Hawza, who would come out of the seminaries, would preach a referendum to validate a republic, an Islamic republic.
You have to be as big as the universe itself in order to tackle this kind of problem.
Exactly.
This is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Exactly.
Because we believe,
mm.
you know.
Mm.
By the way, Imam Khomeini lived according to his beliefs.
Yeah, sorry. But on the background that you had dictatorship in the form of monarchy. Where the vote was not heard of, and when the CIA got whiff of the fact that Mossadegh, the prime minister in 1951,
you know,
was going down this road.
It's easy to say that the system was monarchy.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
But for them, they acted like a pharaoh. They were so big.
Yeah.
I mean, they would call themselves all this king of kings.
Kings, yes.
They called themselves the shadow of God.
Yes, there was also that claim.
That made the story different.
Yes.
I mean, for us, after revolution, we're talking about, Brother Ejaz, this is years after revolution, the Islamic revolution we're talking. It's so easy to talk.
Yeah.
But in order to put yourself in that situation, it's very difficult and it takes time. And it takes a struggle in order to understand it.
Yeah.
You know, our claim is this,
mm-hmm.
that Islam is a perfect one,
yeah.
perfect program for humanity,
sure.
the entire globe.
Sure.
So this is a big claim.
Yeah.
And Imam Khomeini, in claiming and believing in this, is no exception.
No.
But the thing is that as a great leader, everything he claimed, he had to have a backup.
Yeah.
a social understanding to begin with.
Yeah.
Okay? After all, Islam is a collective, comprehensive, general, it's a broad religion,
yeah,
which claims that it can take good care of every human
need,
affairs and needs.
And needs, yes.
And it will. Yeah. You have to prove it that.
Where?
Because we have to come up with a social and economical and political system.
Yeah.
And you know, nowadays...
Well, I mean, to be fair...
You can see the result of
to
it.
To be fair, as you say, that, you know, when you put this into a context, and that's very important in terms of research, and that is what you're saying, that the approach has to be comprehensive. Because if you... It's like, you know, like we're doing modeling, for example. I mean, I come from an engineering background, and of course, if your model lacks...
Which makes a good example.
Yeah. If your model lacks certain assumptions which don't really fill the parameters of the exact thing that you're trying to analyze, well, the result is going to be pretty
and
skewed.
And you always have, in order to write a good building,
yeah,
you always have to use the plumb line.
Exactly, exactly. But what I'm saying here is that we want to put all the ingredients into our research approach so that we get the right kind of... we take the right kind of... what do you call the result that we really need in terms of understanding the entire approach that this great personality did? Because as you say, the claim is very great. But to be fair, in the context of history, even though, you know, that's very controversial, and many of us who have studied Muslim history in the past come away with a very negative impression of the overall picture of what the Muslim world was like for many, many centuries, but we can't ignore the fact that Islam, even in whatever shape or form it was for many centuries, dominated the entire globe for almost 1,000 years, for which Europe had no answer. Even though the Muslim world was broken up into 3 or 4 empires. There was the Empire of Spain, of Andalusia. There was the Empire of the Mughal India. There was the Empire of the Safavids in Iran. There was the Empire of the Ottomans. So, I mean, although they come in successive chronological order, I mean, we're not saying they're all happening at the same time, but whatever periods of history in which there were fundamental changes, but even though at the end of the day, Europe... whatever modern Europe is now, it couldn't have happened unless Islam was there. So, although we are saying it's a big claim for many, many needs, but it's because there has been a vacuum since the time that these empires collapsed, and then Muslims started to fall backwards economically, politically, because Europe started to take over and started to dominate the rest of history until the present day. But in that light, Imam Khomeini is still coming from a context in which Islam still left a very great legacy for the rest of the world to follow.
Big claim deserves big struggle.
Sure.
Okay, the moment you're not claiming anything, so it's so easy for you to deal with whatever. Nobody's going to ask you. Nobody's going to question you. Nobody's going to challenge you.
Yeah.
But the moment you claim something...
Yeah.
You have to...
validate it.
You have to validate it. You have to come out of it clean.
Sure.
Okay, in order to finish that introduction that I gave
for
those that please they do. Have some problems, you know, we talk about ideology here.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Mm.
Those people, they're coming from different school of thought, whatever, for what different reason. We're not getting into that. Mm. It's not going to help us much.
Mm.
But to those that who claim they always that coming Islam, returning Islam inside the country, the Persia, it's very easy for them to say they call it Arab invasion, which wasn't the case.
No,
you
it
talk
wasn't.
About if you talk about material, how come a great empire like Persian, like old Persian empire, could collapse in a short period of time? And they claim that Arab soldiers, you know, they came to Iran with sword. So Iranian army back then, they didn't have sword to defend their own country.
Let's put it in some historical context. Here we are talking about...
Because when you do research, you have to do a lot of studies.
We are talking about the time...
You have to do a lot of comparisons.
Exactly.
You have to do a lot of different things.
Well, there's a lot of PhDs that have been written on the thesis that have been done on this research. But we're talking about...
I hope those PhDs doesn't mean please hold a debate.
No.
So they should be able, in order to back whatever they say with facts.
But the thing is, that whatever they've come up with, and this has stunned them, in all honesty, when they have come up with these, and I've seen some of these theses, where they have been absolutely stunned by the extraordinary speed with which the Muslim empire started to expand. Because we are talking about, as you quite rightly say, a Persian empire that stood for about 3...
What happened? This is a simple question.
Yeah, 3,500 years... Right? Taking it to its origin, but it only collapses within the 10-year period of the second caliph, if I can put it that way, within a matter of a year or two. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary. How does that happen?
One should ask himself why.
Why? Exactly.
We don't have to give answers to any questions.
No.
I mean, the approach for some people should be differently.
Yeah.
I mean, for as long as you want to stay a student, you're not going to grow.
Yeah.
All these different lectures, speeches you go to, all different books you read, which is fine. Mm. You're supposed to do that.
Sure.
But for a second, come out of yourself. Mm. This is my claim.
Yeah.
This is my way of approaching things.
Sure.
You have to pause for a second and say, look, I am somebody in this creation too.
Sure.
I can be as big as whoever. Mm. I can achieve as much as
whoever
somebody else
did.
Okay?
Sure.
There is an Imam Khomeini inside every single of us, because we're going to talk about that claim. That claim is of a genuine one. Mm. When you talk about justice, you're not talking about something in vacuum.
No.
You talk about reality on the ground. You know, back during Shah's regime,
sure,
we lived it. Mm. I felt it. I saw the unjust, okay, with different talent, good talent, you know, bunch of elite people. Mm. If they were not attached to the system, to the monarch system, if, for example, they disputed, they challenged the system of king, which was very difficult,
sure,
they could face torture, they could face imprisonment, they could face to be sent into exile, just like they sent Imam Khomeini to exile.
Sure, sure.
Okay, what did he do? What did he say for the regime, you know, to actually, if you want to describe it, the way that they took Imam from his house in the Qom, it was some kind of kidnapping.
Sure.
How come a civilization, somebody who claimed that he can take care of people...
Well, Dr. Husni, I wanted to say here that you're drawing a very, very interesting parallel here, because you're drawing a line here where you're saying that it's that interesting...
And my mission here is to raise questions. So many different of them.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is, if you let me finish my point,
please.
That is that there's two interesting parallels you're drawing here. You're drawing about how Iran or the Persian Empire, in the context of the 7th, 8th century, how it quickly was absorbed by Islam, and which was a miracle in itself. And that's something that, as you quite rightly say, is something that, you know, PhDs have been written on. But we are drawing also the fact that the Pahlavi regime in Iran was established for, you know, in a coup d'etat in 1941, the Mohammad Reza Pahlavi that we knew, the one that was...
The role of British behind it.
Yeah, the British and the Americans in the coup.
U.S. administration, yes.
50 years it was established by the great superpowers, the principal superpower being the Americans.
And 50 years is a long way.
A long way, where
to
Iran...
To gain people's heart.
Exactly. And in Iran... It was established as the policeman of the Gulf.
The gendarme of the region.
With a very, very powerful army, one of the strongest in the region. Even Israel was no match for whatever the Shah was getting at the time. And how did that quickly dissolve the way it did by this great personality? I mean, it draws two very interesting parallels about Iran's history in the face of Islam.
Good question again. If you go look at the history, what kind of situation people were in. My answer to you is very simple. It all boils down to one thing. And yes. The word is dignity. We're talking about reference here. لَقَدْ كَرَّمْنَا بَنِي آدَمْ Quran is talking to us. Anytime you want to study somebody, look or study the ideology behind that person. Mentality, behind that person.
Person, yes.
You cannot study Imam Khomeini without knowing Quran.
Would I be wrong in saying, Dr. Hasni, dignity and faith?
Dignity and faith, they're going together. Okay?
Right.
But dignity is something that if somebody claims, you know, on the surface that, oh, I don't believe in, even if I don't believe in God, but I'm not a beast, I'm not animal, I'm human for God's sake, then he says, for God's sake. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Unintentionally
uses
the word.
Word.
Okay?
Because God gave
because
the dignity,
God gave him
the honor and dignity
God,
to man.
God gave it to him.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Dignity is not something...
And it's being trampled on by dictatorship.
Exactly. And this is what you see. If you ask me what happened to Egyptian people, why they came to the Tahrir Square to regain their dignity.
Dignity.
The dignity that it was kidnapped. It was hijacked.
Hijacked.
It was robbed,
I should say. Yes.
This is
robbed,
a better
I
word.
Think, is a better word. Yeah.
If you feel that you are abused, okay?
Yeah.
If you all feel that you are attacked, with every single cell in your entire body, by the way, if you have to talk about this in a deeper and different layer, you have to talk about the definition of human.
Yes.
According to what Islam
says. Yes, that's right, because that's the ideology we're coming from.
Because remember, we're talking about the human problems in general in the last program. And one thing I mentioned that we are trapped into these five...
Senses. That's right.
But there is something beyond that.
Yes.
Okay.
And this is what this expertise also witnessed to the fact that, you know, beyond whatever intelligence or whatever things were there in place in order to because let's be honest here, Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, was never ever envisaged by the Americans or the Soviet Union for that matter that such a person would ever come to power in Iran. They were expecting the Shah to be there forevermore. Amen. So that, as you quite rightly say, according to that, those materialistic senses and sights, the intelligence went badly wrong.
Brother, when one way of studying one society is to get back to their song.
Get back to the hymn sheet.
Exactly. In West,
and start singing from the same one.
In West, you know as well as I do.
Yeah.
There is a song that says "No respect, no respect," and they repeated it.
Yeah.
They mean it. When you're talking about dignity, Mr. Rajos, you're not talking about something in vacuum. You're talking about reality on the ground.
Absolutely.
We are different, by definition, from Quranic. If I get a chance to tell you about the reference and talk about it for a few seconds.
Sure, sure. If not now, we'll do it in the next session. Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Because it's very important in order to understand the root cause for people uprising.
Exactly.
For people, if you ask them why you are not satisfied with your situation. Okay? The respect, the dignity, the nobility. Brother, in one word, we are different than every different creation that the entire universe is based on. We are different in every different aspect. We have so many different dimensions. We have to understand and recognize and study ourselves. We have to get back to the drawing point.
Exactly.
We have to talk about this stuff. Otherwise, you don't know.
Well, this is.
You don't know the immensity of the claim.
Well,
which is big.
Well, let's make an attempt at it anyway, because in a program like this, this is what we're trying to do. But what we are saying is, in our concluding remarks in this particular session, is that knowing thyself, which in transcendent philosophy or anything else you may like, we don't need to get complicated about it. But
no, we need to talk simple.
Simple. But knowing thyself makes you know your creator. And this is something that Imam Khomeini rahmatullah took right to the end of his life, because this is what he was trying to instill in us and to make us wake up to the fact of exactly who we are and what we are. But we'll leave it for this particular moment on this note. But I thank you very much, Dr. Hasni, for this very valuable discussion. Really, I've enjoyed it. And I hope the listeners have enjoyed it too. And I hope you'll join us again on another session of The Man Who Changed the World. Thank you very much for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. May the peace and mercy and blessings of Allah be upon you all.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
COVID vaccines alone will not get rid of the virus in the immediate future. SARS-CoV-2 is spreading rapidly. 10 to 20% of the tests globally turn out to be positive, says Nolan Rapoport, journalist, in an article published under the heading, People Who Get Vaccinated May Still Spread the Virus, and Other Things to Know About COVID-19. Stay tuned for the details, please. Dr. Michelle Carbon of the University of Hawaii Cancer Center and Department of Pathology and an international team of colleagues recently wrote an article, a kind of state of the research summary for the Journal of Oncology that provides reliable, easy to understand information about COVID-19 that is both important and not readily ascertainable in the circus atmosphere of our news media. Here are some highlights. First, the correct terminology. The name of the novel coronavirus is SARS-CoV-2, and it causes a disease called COVID-19 in approximately 30% of the people who are infected. Masks and social distancing help prevent infection, but the only way to be sure that you won't get the virus is to stay home and not have visitors. It's that simple. But this would require us to sacrifice our normal living routines, such as spending time with friends and family, going to restaurants and shopping centers, doing our jobs in a social setting with colleagues, the things that define our lives. Is it worth it? How to manage the risk? Infections occur almost exclusively in enclosed environments. The virus flows in the air as aerosol. Open the windows and the risk of infection drops drastically, according to Carbon and his colleagues. The more crowded the environment, the higher the risk of infection. For example, the risk is very high in a crowded, air-conditioned bus with closed windows. However, the crowded environment of a modern airplane is comparatively safer, they say, because the air in the cabin is filtered and it is exchanged entirely with outside air every 2 to 3 minutes. Because we congregate inside with closed windows during cold winter months, the risk of infection is higher and more likely than. We currently are diverting our attention and resources to trying to contain SARS-CoV-2 infections, which in turn is reducing efforts to prevent and treat cancer and other critical diseases. This could cost many lives. Carbon and his colleagues note that the National Cancer Institute, or NCI, estimated that this could be responsible for approximately 10,000 additional colon and breast cancer deaths because early cancer screening for those diseases has largely been suspended. Moreover, NCI's estimate did not consider other cancer types, and it assumed that all would revert to normal by January 2021, which didn't happen. The actual number of collateral deaths may be much higher. According to Carbon and his colleagues, approximately 70% of SARS-CoV-2 infections are asymptomatic, but testing largely targets people who have symptoms. Consequently, we are underestimating the magnitude of infections. We also are overestimating the deaths caused by COVID-19, they say. Anyone who dies who has tested positive for COVID-19 is counted as a victim of the virus. We do not determine whether virus was the main cause of death. 3 in 4 seriously ill patients are men, and most fatalities occur in older individuals with pre-existing conditions. COVID-19 deaths in those younger than 40 with no pre-existing conditions are very rare. RNA vaccines use new technology that has not been applied to mass vaccinations previously. Antibodies are the proteins produced by the immune system that protect us from infection. Approximately 95% of the vaccinated subjects have developed IgG antibodies, which should protect them from the virus. But these vaccines have been tested mainly on healthy adults younger than 60. The few older individuals who have received the vaccines produce fewer IgG antibodies. The vaccines haven't been tested on children. These vaccines will not stop the spread of COVID-19. IgG antibodies circulate in our blood and protect us from a systematic infection, that is, from viruses spreading inside our body and making us sick. A different kind of antibody called IgG protects the body's muscle surfaces, such as the nose, pharynx, and intestine. So far, no clinical trials are being performed on vaccines that produce IgG antibodies. The vaccines being tested only produce IgG antibodies. This means that the SARS-CoV-2 virus can still infect surfaces of vaccinated individuals. IgG antibodies from their vaccinations should stop the virus from spreading inside their bodies, but virus that grows on the surfaces in their bodies can spread to other people. However, people who are infected produce both IgG antibodies, so once they have recovered from the infection, they are safe. Reinfections are extremely uncommon. When more than 60% of the population have antibodies that protect them from the virus, viral spread will decrease because the virus will not be able to find susceptible targets easily. This is called herd immunity. No one knows how long herd immunity will last, but for SARS, which is caused by a closely related virus, it lasts several years. The main or only reason to vaccinate children is to protect adults, according to Carbon and his colleagues. Children, except those with some serious diseases or genetic conditions, generally do not get sick with COVID-19. COVID-19 vaccinations cause pain, fever, and headaches that last a few days in most adult recipients. We do not know what the side effects would be in children. The fact that vaccines currently being tested will not produce IgG antibodies would not be a big problem if everybody were to be vaccinated, but that isn't likely to happen. Therefore, these vaccines alone will not get rid of the virus in the immediate future. SARS-CoV-2 is spreading rapidly. 10 to 20% of the tests globally turn out to be positive. Therefore, according to Carbon and his colleagues, a combination of vaccinations and infections should produce herd immunity soon, possibly by June, when COVID-19 will decrease and hopefully almost disappear soon after. Meanwhile, more effective treatments are being developed, thus the death rate from COVID-19 should decrease in coming months.
Hezbollah said it shot down an Israeli drone near the border town of Blida. The downing of the drone comes as the Israeli military has recently intensified its violations of the Lebanese airspace as part of what Hezbollah calls an ongoing spying operation against the resistance movement. Hezbollah fighters have so far downed several unmanned Israeli aircraft over the Lebanese territory. But Tel Aviv's frequently violating Lebanon's airspace is seen by many as a flagrant violation of UN Security Council Resolution 1701 and the country's sovereignty.
I think that Israel really is disregarding territorial sovereignty in general in Lebanon, in Gaza, and other places as well, Syria, Iraq. Israel has bombed militia in Iraq, and it's also involved its attack to forces in Libya as well. So I don't think that Israel really cares about honoring international protocols, international law. It just at will violate any country's territory as long as it feels it's in its interest to do so. And I think it's been violating Lebanese territory for decades, really.
But such Israeli violations are not limited to Lebanon. On Tuesday, Palestinian resistance forces downed an Israeli drone in southern Gaza and took control of it. The Israeli military confirmed one of its drones crashed in Gaza, but claimed there was, quote, no danger of information leak. On Sunday, Palestinian fighters also shot down an Israeli quadcopter, which was conducting an espionage mission over Beit Hanun crossing in Gaza's northern border with the occupied territories. The Israeli military frequently uses drones over the Gaza Strip either to monitor and photograph Palestinian military units or bomb specified targets.
It uses drones regularly in Lebanon, I think, too, and in the Gaza Strip. It uses them for intelligence gathering. It's trying to watch what people do in those places. It's looking for militant activities that could be construed as, building missiles. It's looking for people that might be building tunnels under Gaza to defend Gaza in the next battle invasion from Israel. So these drones are an important intelligence tool for Israel. And drones are important intelligence tools for all the countries that make drones, the United States as well, and in countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eklima Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948. ¶¶
the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997. Various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, as most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labour Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality really in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
And this is Ben Bernanke, is on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarize that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owns shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices. And that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we see that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017 when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever, but it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar. They've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, you know, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied. And you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. The UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
IRIB English Radio.